Just five verses.
Then the king will say to those on his right hand, come you whom my father has blessed, take for your heritage the kingdom prepared for you since the foundation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you made me welcome. Naked and you clothed me. Sick and you visited me. In prison and you came to see me. Then the virtuous will say to him in reply, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and make you welcome, naked and clothe you, sick or in prison and go to see you? And the king will answer, I tell you solemnly, insofar as you did this to the one of the least of these people of mine, you did it to me. And that ends the reading. Before I launch into my sermon proper, I really want to take this opportunity to say thank you so very, very much to people that are helping with this service. And for that lovely music, I thought the first song was that I associate with the singing by Bob Dylan was much better sung by Nancy. Don't you agree? Thank you so very much. And thank you, Carolyn. I get up here, and you think with all my experience, I would be just a natural for this. I'm not. She keeps me on the straight and narrow. When time and history collide and inspire. The challenge the worship committee put out for the summer theme has been, who has inspired the path you are on today and what sustains you? The events and political dynamics of these days encouraged us to believe sharing our own experiences would be helpful to all of us. I am fortunate there have been and are people who have inspired me and who sustain me. They have done so in the context of my coming into my adulthood in the 60s, which had all the good music. At a place in time in history when events and peoples were colliding, and we are again at such a time. Specifically, I find that the questions and concerns of my grandchildren, who are now coming of age, parallel to mine when I was coming into my age. I'm going to paint a picture of my world through a series of brief vignettes and let you find your own parallels from your time and experience. A few days will help. Dates will help. I was a pre-World War II baby born in 1940, and along with an older brother and a younger sister, grew up in the very white, very lovely northern New Jersey suburb of Chatham. My parents were loving and caring. Gramp, my Long Island potato farmer grandfather, was inspirational. And my brother and sister were and are interesting, caring, and supportive siblings. I graduated from college in 1962, Lori and I married in 1963, and I graduated from Episcopal Seminary in 1966. Our children were all born in the 60s, and our first grandchildren in the 90s. A very early vignette. My father, along with my brother, would take turns with others to mow the lawns of families where the dads were off fighting World War II. A very big day for me at age 5 was our neighborhood march, with everyone celebrating the end of the war and the return of the dads who served in the military. We were a single bonded community, even including the Roman Catholic neighbors. They were kind of the outlanders in this community. Not that far out, but the vivid memory of that day was supplemented at points in the years that followed, including pictures and accounts of American diversity that seemed to cohere in my mind as that picture that I had as a 5-year-old became more complete. The Navajo code talkers, the African-American airmen, old posters of Rosie the Riveter. My sense of the meaning of diversity deepened my 5-year-old victory march feelings as I grew older. The rector of our Episcopal church, who later encouraged me to go to Haverford, his college, and then to seminary, shared with me his World War II experience. He was a first-generation German-American who studied under a Quaker pacifist at Haverford, Rufus Morley Jones, and then went on to the Episcopal Theological School in New York City, General Seminary. He described to me visiting relatives in Germany in 1938, including among the people he visited, an uncle who was an SS officer, and then coming away from that visit knowing that what was happening was horrible and that war would be a necessary result. This minister that I grew up under, he served as a military chaplain throughout the entire war. And so he deepened my feelings and understanding of that five-year-old who went in the neighborhood victory march. And then the picture gets more complicated with later revelations. Lori shared with me a frightful time in her teens when her father, a second-generation Russian Jew and working for the National Labor Relations Committee, came under investigation by the Joseph McCarthy investigations. Yes, there were witch trials anew, long after the Salem witch trials. Other voices finally prevailed as McCarthyism escalated and then collapsed under its own weight. Pressured by a call by a special counsel to the Army, Joseph Welch, confronting Senator McCarthy in a hearing, "Have you no decency?" The 1964 movie Point of Order captured that moment. And you know, today, thankfully, I am hearing voices of decency, echoes. The mounting tirades are building a tower that will collapse under its own weight when confronted by common sense and decency. The words are different now, but the form is amazingly similar to what we are hearing. McCarthyism collapsed. Calling people's names lost its power, but there were costs. Many people afraid withdrew into themselves. There were actors who were banned from Hollywood. And maybe the worst one was the expulsion from the State Department of people who knew China and Asia. They were lumped together as old China hands and denigrated and pushed out. Read the biography of Julia Childs. She served in the Far East, and her husband, an interesting person in his own right, was once one of those old China hands. And today, I just hope we can rebuild our science community in our government operations. And I know it will take a while. Despite the fear-mongering, there was still inside me the excitement and inspiration of people coming together and winning World War II. Maybe early impressions have staying power. My next vignette comes from both my college and seminary years, and really begins in 1960. I was attending Haverford College, studying Quaker beliefs, among other things, and at the end of my sophomore year, signed on with a project of the American Friends Service Committee, working with patients in an old-fashioned state mental hospital outside of Louisville, Kentucky. Many patients no longer needed to be warehoused in old facilities, but did need help to become deinstitutionalized. The Quakers thought that college students could help. Maybe we did. There are now people, mind you, who have been warehoused in prisons, including mentally ill people. There are efforts now to change warehousing people. Things come around. Important to me, as it turns out, Lori, having finished her first year of college, learned of the same Quaker project through her home Unitarian Church Fellowship in Shreveport, Louisiana. A lot happened that summer, including our finding we'd like to hold hands. And right now comes the vignette that found us moving into the civil rights movement. On a weekend field trip that summer, we went down to Eastern Tennessee to the Highlander Folk School. You can Google this, find more. Highlander Folk School. That previous spring, our opening hymn that we sang this morning, "We Shall Not Be Moved," had been introduced. We shall not overcome. I'm sorry. And that's made, my mind flipped because it's built partly out of a union hymn song prior to that. "We Shall Overcome" had been introduced in South Carolina to the emerging civil rights movement just that spring by a folk songer and collector from the Highlander Folk School by the name of Guy Carawan. He taught us, Laura and I and our other college student friends, that song. There were African Americans in the group and also at my Quaker college. We got to know them and respect them, but didn't know how to be really good friends. We insulated ourselves with people we were comfortable with, and I look back at that with some sense of shame. In 1963, with a baby in tow, we went to Cambridge for me to attend the Episcopal Theological School. We made friends with African-American seminarians while studying together, caring for our babies together, a uniquely bonding experience, and strategizing on the church's need to step up and live up to the charge. "Even as you have done it to the least of these, my people, you have done it to me." The words resonated in us, and they were favorites of Lori from her Unitarian roots and her own studies. A large number of seminarians joined with other seminarians from all over and many faiths to maintain a long-term vigil in front of the Lincoln Monument until the Civil Rights Act was passed. You heard a little bit about that earlier. And we rejoiced, and my 5-year-old victory march, holding hands with our diverse friends, was reinforced. It was a good day. But standing up can come at a price. The next year, in the summer of 1965, I was working at the seminary library in Cambridge. People in the South, with help from others, were demonstrating and marching to make a difference. And there were those killed, black and white. And one of them was our friend and my seminary and classmate, Jonathan Daniels. When he had gone down, an African-American schoolmate had said, "There are those who will kill you." And there were. He was doing voter registration work with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, and was arrested and jailed in Hainesville, Alabama. He was ambushed along with others by Deputy Sheriff William Coleman after being bailed out of jail. Jonathan was buried in his hometown of Keene, New Hampshire. We went to that funeral. The Episcopal Church service was dignified and emotional at the same time. Jonathan had grown up in Keene, and his mother was a school teacher there. At the end of the interment burial service, some 8 to 10 African Americans from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, led by Stokely Carmichael, gathered around the grave, joined hands and swaying together, sang, "We shall overcome." And the voter registration work went on and goes on. And I shall never forget standing there, holding hands with Lori and holding our son David. Sometimes there is a painful price to be paid. And the killing of civil rights leaders and workers went on. My last 60s vignette says more about the price. While we were making progress in civil rights, our country backed itself into the Vietnam War based in part on an American lie about the Bay of Pigs. Maybe our country might have found a better way if we hadn't dumped our old China hands and their Asian expertise. And maybe President Johnson would not have backed us into a full-scale war, justifying it with a lie. At the time, the war almost seemed like a diversion to move people's attention away from progressing on the civil rights front. Dr. Martin Luther King thought so. I found my own opposition reinforced by Quaker beliefs I learned as a college student. Our young men were being killed, and children were being killed in their villages, a strategic necessity, supposedly, as the enemy hid among them. What hasn't changed? And we would remember the scripture, even as you've done it this to the least of my people, you've done it to me. In March of 1968, an anti-war group I had become a part of, known as the Clergy and Laity Concerned About the War in Vietnam, had a rally in March here in D.C. At the time, I was a curate at St. Peter's Church in Morristown, New Jersey. So we met together down here, first for speeches, which included ones by Dr. King and also William Sloan Coffin, the Yale University Episcopal chaplain, as well as monks and rabbis. We then headed to the Lincoln Memorial. Most of us were to march, but the leaders and speakers were riding a bus. Among those who were getting on the bus was Dr. King and an old rabbi, Abraham Herschel. Anybody here heard that name? Yeah. And he was struggling to carry two great big Old Testament scrolls that had been saved years ago from the Nazis in Germany. I happened to be handy, and being young and strong, I offered to help. And he let me take the scrolls and carry them up into the bus. He took them back from me. I'm not Jewish. And he asked me to sit beside him, though, and to keep him company. As it turns out, Dr. King was across on the other side of the bus. Saw what was going on, and he smiled at us. His two protective aides on either side of him, concerned for things that were to come later that year, 1968, eyed me suspiciously. Not surprisingly, if you read back over that era, you will find that Hoover's FBI looked for a connection between Dr. King and the communists. There were those in the media and in Congress who thought of us all as communist or communist sympathizers, or at best, dupes. You've heard that word. But what I have is a picture of the old rabbi who survived the Holocaust, protesting war along with Dr. King, sitting across from us, knowing his life was at risk. We marched, and we were people of all faiths, and we sang, "We shall overcome." There is progress, and at the same time, so much to do locally, nationally, and internationally for all kinds of people in all kinds of places. Some areas we've made a special progress. We have made significant progress regarding sexuality, particularly homosexuality. There are aspects to it that we maybe are beginning to understand, and that can include ourselves. Many of us have been helped by people being open about themselves, and we are at our best when we march together. A powerful vignette moment for me was 2 years ago, come this October. Three of our grandchildren presented their mama and their mommy, our daughter Rachel, being mama, to be joined in holy wedlock. And we joined them with the blessing of the Episcopal Church, legal recognition by the state of Maryland, and the applause of 150 family members and friends, and the 100% support of this church and our UU friends. But what about those who've gone unnoticed in many parts of rural America? In my work for the Federal Food Stamp SNAP program, this is going back some years now, at least 15, I saw the numbers increasing in rural America and was glad that the program was there to help them. Food is a necessity, but it isn't the only thing needed. For the most part, people were unseen by most of us. Their schools underfunded and depression and addiction on the rise. And now they have been politically capitalized on, but will see no meaningful return. Where were the petroleum companies whose scientists told them about global warming and there was profit and opportunity to invest in people and energy alternatives? Where were the people who could have been developing people and technology for wind energy in the mountains of West Virginia? We all need to see better and look further. There is marching on another front in this time, too, the women's movement. The challenges of women are a standing part of history, but maybe something is different this time. Most women are not isolated, and connectivity can make a difference. Blatant comments get shared, not buried. Victims can discover they are not alone. The Women's March in D.C. was a powerful statement. There were a great many people joining hands together. Lori and I were there. Our daughter-in-laws were there, our daughter was there, our granddaughters were there. Many of you here may remember you heard Lily not long after the march in a coming of age express herself very clearly about where she stands, and you affirmed her. She knows she does not stand alone. Hateful and divisive language and actions are not new. Seemingly patriotic and faith-based language can be used to gloss over an underlying sense of fear and a need to protect ourselves. Fear-mongering and then violence becomes a part of the picture. As happened in the past, though, the hatefulness is seen and rejected by more and more people, and that is happening now. In our lives, the sense of community and what can be achieved together, what I felt as a five-year-old, is basic. And people with determination and decency holding hands will prevail. Three things I close with. First, Lily, you will always have our hands to hold when you march. Second, Lori, I'm glad that we started holding hands in the 60s and that we continue to do so. And finally, to all of us, in all our variety and our goodness, let us march holding hands. Thank you.